My name is Alexandra Joseph. I'm a non-exec director at Bright Blue and sit on the board. In my day job, I work at JLL, the real estate company, working in the residential capital markets team. We're delighted to be joined by three speakers. I promise we'll be three shortly. Bim Akhilani is on the way. He is MP for Hitchin and Harpenden, and he served as a PPS in the Department of Transport and as a member of the Public Accounts Select Committee. We're delighted to be joined also by Professor Danny Dorling. He is Professor of Geography at the School of Geography and the Environment at the University of Oxford. His work concerns issues of housing, health inequality and employment. He's also the author of the 2014 book All That Is Solid, The Great Housing Disaster. We also have here Polly Neat, Chief Executive of the charity Shelter. Shelter actually recently published findings of their commission on the future of social housing, in which Ryan Shortcast, director of Bright Blue, participated. That was Building for Our Future, a vision for social housing. So the theme of housing shortage needs little introduction, but it's probably felt by a few people in this room as well. An often accepted measure of affordability by housing associations is that rent is no more than 30% of income. If you look at the average one-bed rent, it's actually more than 30% in over 65% of British postcode areas. Housing affordability generally particularly impacts young people, often referred to as generation rent, who need to share a rental accommodation or live with mum and dad to make ends meet, making it difficult to save for their own home in the future. And you may have seen Bright Blue's pulling out today that actually found that making housing more affordable is the one priority that young people would think would help them most today. That was 55% of 18 to 34 year olds. Housing starts have recently improved. It's estimated that 218,000 homes were delivered in 2017 and 2018. That's against an annual target of 300,000. But just yesterday, government figures showed that London had its lowest housing starts in Q1 of 2019 for the last 10 years, and that was 50% lower than the same time last year. So we have a number of questions for our panelists this afternoon, including what are the causes and consequences of the housing crisis? What tax, regulatory and policy changes are required to increase home ownership? For example, does home help to buy public work? What do we make of Boris's proposals to cut stamp duty? How has the affordability and quality of private renting capital been improved? Do we need to, and if so, how can we boost the supply of social housing for more young people to live in? And we'll also ask our speakers to consider if there are significant changes in the attitudes of young people towards the type of accommodation they live in. Is the housing market also being transformed by new types of provision, for example, built-to-rent, shared ownership, and co-living, to name a few? So I think, before I ask our speakers to say a few words, a quick straw poll, if you don't mind revealing, are you a renter in the room? And are you a homeowner? Right. Are there any renters that would want to become owners? And are there any renters that would actually wish to continue renting if they could? We've got one there. Okay, thank you very much for that. It's interesting to see what the audience comprises. Right, without further ado, I will invite Professor Danny Dorling to open for 5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes. Well, let's carry on the poll slightly. Who's still paying off their mortgage? It's got a mortgage. Who owns outright? Who owns more than one property outright? There we go, thank you. That, you are representative of Britain, if we say there's about 100 people here. That there's probably one or two more people who own more than one who haven't put their hands up. You can accidentally become a landlord and so on. But in general, we're a society of a large number of private renters, a smaller group of social renters, a shrinking group of people with mortgages, pretty hefty group of people who own outright, but obviously that isn't going to rise in the future, and then a relatively small group of landlords The majority of whom are amateur landlords who've accidentally found their way into owning one property because he had one, she had one, they got together, you have a spare one. And a tiny number of landlords, private sector landlords, who rent out a large number of properties. I'm just going to start with something the keynote speaker said, because I think it's pertinent. And he's talking about the positive things. I mean, there are a lot of positive things going on, particularly in the world. But he mentioned leisure and travel, and young people's opportunity for leisure and travel improving. Now, on average, it might be. But we are very close to 50% of young people in Britain, children, no longer having a single holiday a year away from family and friends. They might go and stay with their grandfather or grandmother this summer for a weekend, but they won't have a week in Haven. And the thing which is perhaps more shocking or surprising, if you know the statistics, and this comes from the household below average income stats, which are from a survey of the whole population. The thing which is more surprising is we're seeing rising numbers of families who can't afford a single holiday saying that they don't need one because they've become used to not having a holiday at all. So we're becoming a little bit more like the United States where that's normal. And of course at the same time, for the average to be, as our keynote speaker said, more opportunities, more holiday, more leisure, more travel, a few of us are having many more holidays. If you look at the best of 20% of children, you're looking at 6, 7, or 8 holidays a year, as opposed to the half who have none. Why is this related to housing? Because the cost of housing is so high, their parents couldn't possibly ever imagine having a holiday in the summer holidays. It's really telling that London starts have halved to 50%. Something is definitely going on with the London housing market. It is teetering. There was properties which are on Zoopla for 1.6 million, where if you were to offer them a million right now, they will take it. Obviously, it's a time of massive economic insecurity, particularly in London, with October the 31st looming and a finance sector with no passports, as far as I know, whatsoever. So it's an interesting time for housing. What can be done to improve owner occupation? I think there's two things. One is actually seeing it as a legitimate aspiration for people who really want to look after a home, do the DIY, don't want a landlord, and so on. I've always been in favour of right to buy for that reason. Some people just want to have control over the property that they're in. But the second thing is realising that if you create an environment, which much of Europe has, where it is not necessary to own, then you have far fewer people trying to own, and then it's far easier for the people who want to own to own. And we don't do that. We set up an environment in which, unless you manage to get yourself a property, you're really looking at a very bad old age. And so you try the hardest you can to be an owner occupier, and most people fail. How does the rest of Europe do it, and in particular, of course, Germany, but also Austria and Vienna? They do it by ensuring that you can't speculate on housing. You can buy a home, but you shouldn't expect it to be worth more when you sell it as when you buy it. And until you have that as an actual goal, and until you have an electorate who will accept you telling them that, because at the moment the electorate will vote for you, 40% of them, if you promise to increase their house prices, in effect, until you get to the point of realising that at some point, as compared to wages, housing prices can't rise, you can't begin to sort these things out. In a way, some of the solutions are technically very simple. The problem is political. The problem is if you set up an electorate where a proportion think that they own something that's worth an enormous amount of money, you have a problem. And I think that's really where we are in Britain at the moment. There is a majority of old people in this country own outright, and they think the home they're in is worth 300,000, 400,000 if it's in the south of England. They are not yet aware that young people won't be able to pay that much for it. At the moment they can sell to landlords, which is what people increasingly sell to. The problem with selling to private landlords is that a private landlord will attempt to maximise their profit. That's how the market works. And so at the extreme, what you have in London are maisonettes, which used to be social housing, used to house a family of four, mother and father and two children. They exercised the right to buy. When they came to sell, they sold to the highest bidder, which was a private landlord. The private landlord then puts them on the market, and the maisonette is then rented by one young professional who has the greatest buying power. And suddenly, rather than having four people in that unit, you've got one. And if you want to kind of sum up of what's the problem in London, that's the problem. You've gone from having a sector which was allocated on the basis of need, which was by far the most efficiently filled, because you wouldn't allocate anybody a maisonette if there weren't enough of them to fill it, to a sector allocated on the basis of profit, and it does make a lot of profit for the landlords, but it leaves a lot of people very badly housed, underhoused, and so on. I better wrap up, so I'll just wrap up with the very bottom end, which is, why are you seeing more people on the streets? Accelerating numbers of people on the streets. In my home city of Oxford, we have one of the highest rises. There are now tents outside the gates of Trinity College Cambridge and Trinity College Oxford, permanently there. We had 6 deaths over the winter of homeless people. Turned out that 4 of them were local. Nobody yet knows where the lad from Poland actually came from who died outside the train station. But Otis, who was in the year below me at school, and Sharon, who was in the year below my little brother, everybody knows where they're from, and they're in Oxford because they're local. Why were they homeless? They were homeless because the very bottom end of the private market is now full. The really squalid, nasty little street with the horrible, damp housing that you would have been housed in the past if you'd had issues and you were an unreliable payer. That squalid little street across London, in Oxford, much of the south of England, is now home to a set of American postgraduate students living off a trust fund. And the flat is full. And they've put some new paint on the flat. They might even have put a damp course in, but probably not, because the market doesn't need that. But essentially, the very bottom end of the market, which is what used to keep people off the streets, is full, and that's why you're seeing people on the streets in London and people in the streets in the rest of the southeast of England. It has reached a particular crisis point. All the statistics show that it has. It becomes increasingly difficult to convince young people that a solution is actually being planned for. And the other thing, or the reason why I think all this will stop, is the majority of young women in England now go to university. The majority of young women are graduates. They know they have the right to think. They know they're not stupid. And they're working out that they can't fit into the small percentage of people who will eventually manage to buy a safe home. And because of that, we are at some point going to have to change our culture from one which says, we will do all we can to maximise the value of housing. The city in Europe with the highest house prices must be the most economically successful. We're going to move away from that. The question is, can we move away from that earlier rather than later? And can we move to something that's more sensible, that we don't have to fix again in 40 years' time or quite as quickly as we periodically keep on having to fix our housing solutions? In the past, you need a wide range of options. People desperately need security. Children in particular need security. Majority of children now in London are renting privately. Their parents are renting privately. Tenancies tend to last 3 years. You need to stay at school for more than 3 years because it's good to keep friends. It needs sorting out. But working out also what you're going to has to be done. It shouldn't simply be a return to the 1970s. And where we lack political imagination, that we didn't lack in the past, when we came up with innovative solution after innovative solution for housing, all the way from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, what appears to be utterly dire at the moment is imagination for housing for many people rather than a few small schemes that will help upper middle class people like me or our children house themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Danny. So a few points there, starting out with leisure and travel, also pointing out the bottom of the housing ladder is full, and this important point around the need for security. With apologies, Ben has been called away from vote and has realised that he can't make it, so unfortunately we have two speakers down, in which case I won't limit the 5 minutes
I really want to pick up actually on that point about culture change because I think that is important and incredibly difficult. And I think, so if I think about myself, so I didn't put my hand up, but I do own my own home and I'm jolly glad to do so, and I completely sympathise with everybody else who wants to own their own home. And I also pick up on the point, so the reason that the idea of house prices is falling is extremely scary to me and to lots of the other people in the room who own their own home, is because I don't have a fantastic pension. I've never worked in the public sector, I don't have a final salary pension, so I'm not badly paid to be chief executive shelter, we can all talk about that, I'll definitely defend that. But nevertheless, I need my home to be worth a reasonable amount because that is my future security. And a lot of people feel like that. So to create a culture change that stops me and everyone else being dependent on the value of their own home in that way is a massive undertaking. And the kind of engine of that, the culture shift that I really want to talk about, is one that really hit me when I first joined Shelter nearly 2 years ago. It was really obvious then, and it's really obvious to me now actually, and I'm going to explain why, that the only way out of the national emergency that our housing crisis has become is to build social housing. And when I said that at Shelter, I was told, you absolutely cannot talk about social housing, it's completely countercultural, nobody is interested in talking about it, it hasn't been fashionable for decades, you will never get a room of Conservatives talking about social housing, so just, they're in government, so just forget it. And I was absolutely astonished by this. So it is really true that in order to seriously invest in social housing, we need a cultural shift. But I think we are moving towards that cultural shift, and I'm really quite optimistic about it. I'm more optimistic that we can create a culture shift to invest in social housing than I am that we can create a culture shift that makes people like me feel comfortable about house prices falling. And I'll tell you why I think that. So I think there are kind of three ways of looking at the case for social housing. There's kind of the moral or human case for it, which we've heard a bit about, the bottom end of the housing market or fact that most people don't even have access to that. There's the economic case, and then there's the political case. So I'm just going to really briefly address all three bits of that. So I'm going to start with the moral or human case, because that's the case that we at Shelter go on about the most, because it's the case that's easiest to get the media to talk about. And basically, I think that what we have been thinking of as the housing crisis as a crisis of aspiration, so the fact that people's aspirations are limited by the lack of housing, I actually think it's much more severe than that. It's actually a crisis of hope now. So the people we're seeing at Shelter are not people whose aspirations will no longer be fulfilled. They're people who have lost hope. And if we're talking specifically about young people, children who are growing up homeless, which is currently nearly 30,000 children, have much less chance of growing up into resilient, fulfilled and contributing adults than children who are growing up in a secure home. because moving schools continually, having no way you can invite your friends to, not having enough space, and I've spoken to mums whose babies aren't meeting their developmental milestones because the B&B room that they're living in is wall-to-wall beds and there's no room to crawl. So baby, and you wouldn't put your baby down to crawl in the corridor outside, I can tell you. So kids who are not meeting their developmental milestones because of the lack of suitable housing, their future is going to be, unless something happens, is going to be fairly severely damaged by that. So young people who are growing up homeless, children growing up homeless. I also think there's a human case for social housing because people without social rent, people have no opportunity to save in order to buy their own home. So I believe social housing should be available for people who will one day aspire to own their own home, but who at the moment are one of the 800,000 people in private renting who can't even save £10 a month after they've paid their rent. Well, that is not somebody who is ever realistically going to be able to save enough to move into home ownership. There's one in three low-earning renters are actually having to borrow money in order to pay their rent. Well, again, those people can't even hope for a stable home, never mind to move into home ownership. So even at the end of the kind of hope spectrum, where what people are hoping for is home ownership, without social rent, so a sub-market rent, by which I don't mean 80% of market rent, which is the definition of so-called affordable housing. I mean something is affordable so that people on low or low-ish, 800,000, those 800,000 renters need room to headroom to be able to afford to own their own home. And at the very sharpest end, we have 1.1 million people on the waiting list for social housing. So those aren't those 800,000 renters who have hope for home ownership. I think they should have social rent housing, actually, to help them own their own home. But I'm now talking about the people who, under current criteria, it has been decided that they should have a social home. There's 1.1 million of them on the waiting list. And last year, despite the statistics about how many homes have been built, we only built 6,500 social rent homes. So that's 1.1 million on the waiting list, 6,500 new social homes built. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So you've got different groups, haven't you? You've got the people right at the bottom on the waiting list. You've got people who, I'm saying, should have access to social rent so they can save. You've got young people who are growing up homeless who should be in social housing, those children. They should be in a home that their parents can afford to rent where they can at least crawl around on the floor. And then you've got also at the sharpest end, nearly 300,000 people who are actually homeless. They're not on the streets, so that's about around 5,500 only. That's the real tip of an iceberg. But there are 300,000 people who are living in total unsuitable accommodation, bed and breakfast, in hostels. Many of them are families. It's not okay. So that's the moral or human case to invest in social housing. And I think it's pretty conclusive. But in case it isn't, I also think the economic case is really important too. So at the moment, housing benefit is frozen, which means that now in over 90% of the country, housing benefit doesn't enable you to afford the cheapest rates. So at the moment it's frozen, it's going to have to be unfrozen. I think it's pretty generally accepted that in the spending review, housing benefit will be unfrozen. It's going to be unfrozen in 2020 anyway. The problem with that is that you can't actually, you can't not have some sympathy with the government's motivation in freezing housing benefit. And the reason for that is that housing benefit, unfrozen, just goes up as rents go up. So it's a commitment to a benefit that has no ceiling. And that money is being poured straight into the pockets of private landlords. What? It makes absolutely no sense. Now, before you run away and thinking that the CEO, and please don't tweet, that the CEO of Shelter thinks that we should be freezing housing benefits, because I absolutely don't think that. It is causing homelessness, the fact that it's frozen. Make no mistake about it. But the only moral way, so I'm kind of on the moral slash economic case here, it's my sort of segue into the economic case. The only moral way to cap the housing benefit bill is to build social housing. That is the only answer. You have to build housing that people on housing benefit will be able to afford. Otherwise, housing benefit is going to be a bottomless pit, well, it's not a bottom, the bottomless pockets of private landlords into which you are pouring taxpayers' money. And I'm a taxpayer, and I really don't want to see my taxes being spent in that way. I would much rather they were spent on social housing. And talking about investing taxpayers' money, you're right, you know, we have had a culture where we haven't talked about social housing. No idea why. Taxpayers are perfectly happy their taxes to be invested in building hospitals or building schools. Why not in building homes, which A, appreciate in value better, and B, you get rent? What's the problem? I don't really understand why there is one. I think the economic case is absolutely watertight. Our commission, Ryan Shorthouse, as has been said, is one of our commissioners on our commission on social housing. Our commission recommended building 3.1 million social homes over 20 years. I'm not ashamed of that figure. It's a massive figure. That would be paid back after 30 years on the savings in housing benefit alone. Never mind the other economic return on building social homes, which is quite considerable. It is the only way, economically, to end the housing crisis. You can't build 300,000 homes a year with a market for them unless around half of them are social homes. There simply isn't the market. Social homes is what there is a market for. And you do get money on them, you do get rent. It takes a lot longer to make a profit, which is why it's important that the state invests. It's asking a lot for a private landlord to charge social rent, but it's a perfectly legitimate way for the state to get a longer return on its investment. Then I'm going to talk about the political case, because I think there's an absolutely watertight political case as well. And the first point of that is, I don't think it can escape anyone's notice that we are living in a fundamentally and quite frighteningly divided country at the moment. And I think we are seeing a much more extreme reaction to similar issues on both the left and the right. Those divisions are absolutely being fed by the housing crisis. And I believe that ending the housing crisis by building social housing is one way that any government would be able to heal those divisions. And in fact, our polling at Shelter has found that well over 75% of both Leave and Remain voters believe that we should build more social housing. Now, that's really important, because at some point a new government is going to have to pivot onto the domestic agenda. And my job is to make sure that housing is absolutely at the top of that agenda, and it should be. And young people's attitudes to social housing are changing as well. So the housing crisis is feeding disenchantment among young people. And in 2017, 14% of 18 to 24-year-olds and 28% of 25 to 49-year-olds said they would want to live in social housing, okay? 14% 18 to 24, 28% 25 to 49. In 2018, just a year later, that had gone up to 31%, so that's nearly a third of 18 to 24 year olds, and 43%, up from 28%, of 35 to 49 year olds. Now I think that's because people simply cannot save any money living in private equity. And in the 2017 general election, the changing attitudes of private renters were more significant in the swing away from the Conservative vote than the small increase in the turnout among young people. It was the changing attitudes of private renters politically was very significant in the 2017 general election results. And we did polling at Shelton in 60 marginal seats, and we found that housing was the key issue. And marginal voters ranked building social housing more highly than they ranked Help to Buy. Reason? Because a social housing tenancy is more likely to enable them to own their own home than Help to Buy is. That's why. Because either it enables them to stay, or it gives them access to the right to buy. The right to buy is now a tiny, tiny, around 5% proportion of new home ownerships. Why? Because there's nothing to buy. There's no social housing. We're not building any social housing. That's not to say, so I'm not against the right to buy. What I'm against is not building social housing. Yeah? You've got to replace housing that is lost under the right to buy, but I would love to see the new, we're working on this actually, Shelter, the new right to buy that allows people to save while paying a social rent and then turns into homeowners. But again, it's impossible without building social housing. So I believe that the moral or human case, the economic case, and the political case for building social housing mean that I can't understand why we still need a culture change in order to invest in it. And I certainly don't believe we need a culture change in order to persuade a room full of Conservatives that investing in social housing is the right thing.
Thank you very much, Polly, for setting out that case for social housing there. We've got half an hour left. Any questions immediately from the floor? Don't go to the Borough Councillors, and young man.
Yes.
Do say who you are.
I'm Peter Wilson. I live in East Yorkshire. I've only ever lived in Yorkshire and the West Midlands. I was the founder of the Harrogate Families Housing Association, and I sat on the Wolverhampton Homes, the social housing provider for Wolverhampton. We do need to build new homes, social homes. One of the systems of doing it is these system-built homes, which can go up on a site in 3 to 4 days, and it's got all the facilities in. We used to call them prefabs after the war, and some of them are still standing. But now we can build proper family-type homes using that system. We need to do that. The second thing we need to do is to buy up those empty stores in city centres and turn them into housing, because immediately you've got housing that's available. If we did those two things, we can start to increase the amount of social housing available. And from a political point of view, as Conservatives, that's something we need to be doing. I'd like to hear the views of the panel on those two ways of doing it. And living in Yorkshire, I actually lived in what was called, and is called, the Golden Triangle. I was born in Harrogate, I lived near York, and that area has the same problems as well.
Okay, thank you very much. And jump to the front here.
Hi, Tim Parkinson from Nationwide Building Society. I'm just wondering what the pushback is from the government about, given that there's this really strong case for social housing, why are they not doing it? Why are they not kind of endorsing that policy yet? And then I was also thinking about, in terms of social housing, defining it a little bit more specifically, like who should be building and managing social housing? Who's the best provider? Is it the councils? Is it housing associations? Or is it perhaps more unique structures like community land trusts and housing cooperatives? What's kind of good mix for that? What works, what doesn't?
Great. Thank you very much.
Pauline,
do
you want to comment?
Yeah, absolutely right, and I'm delighted to hear you echoing what I said about needing to build social housing. Interestingly, so you're absolutely right, there are a lot of new ways of building now, involving what we might have called prefabs. Prefab is a bit of a loaded term, isn't it? It sounds really bad. but actually, some of these new methods of building are really exciting. And the other thing about social housing is that we won't actually be able to encourage new ways of house building in the country and companies to take these on board without a kind of long-term order book.
Yeah.
And social housing can provide that. So we're much more likely to see the development of these new technologies and new ways of building, which I agree with you, can offer the sort of level of quality that we need at the speed that we need it. So I totally agree with you that we need to look at that, and I also I think it's important to make the point that if we want to encourage these technologies, we will need a long-term commitment to social housing actually in order to do it. In terms of empty buildings, so we have a project actually in Scotland where we're working with the Scottish Government, Shelter, to bring empty buildings back into use, and I do agree with that. A note of caution around quality. So I think it is really important that there are proper standards of quality enforced. And I think where you see, for example, former office buildings converted into housing, you do end up with housing that is not of appropriate quality and sometimes isn't even safe. So I just want to add that note of caution. But with that caveat, I completely agree. On the point about why do we get pushback from government, so I wouldn't actually describe it as pushback, actually. So the Housing Minister, Kit Malthouse, is very much engaged in the debate about social housing. I think it's safe to say there isn't a lot going on in government about anything. no offence to anyone in the room, but there isn't a lot going on. So I think rather than pushback, I think it is that the focus is elsewhere at the moment. I think where we get a bit of... So there is no getting around the fact that although there are other sources of finance, this will require a significant amount of grant funding from central government. And that's why I kept talking about the case for spending taxpayers' money on social housing. Because there is no getting around the fact, as I say, it's going to cost money and the government is going to have to come up with some of that money. So I think if there's not so much pushback, but if there's a bit of reticence about it, I think it's about the level of investment that's required rather than the principle of building social housing, which I don't think there is an awful lot of pushback on. In terms of who should build it, we already have a mixed market in building social housing, and I think that needs to continue. I think developments need to be acceptable to local communities. And that means that as much local decision making as possible in those developments needs to happen. And that means different structures depending on where you are. So in some local areas, the local council has the level of engagement from its population and the will and ability to be genuinely consultative and make sure that what is built is in keeping with what people want their local community to look like. In other local areas, that may not be the case, or it may be the case that a community land trust or another type of vehicle that gives local communities more say is better. In some cases, it is obviously going to be housing associations that are going to end up building the social housing we need. So that's going to be very much the case in many areas. So I think it's going to be a mixture, and I don't want to be sort of dogmatic about who should build it, I don't think there's any getting around, and I think it is important to be clear about this and not shy away from the fact that investment will be needed from central government. And it's very interesting that I've been going around talking to a lot of MPs about social housing, trying to win backing for the case to build more social housing. And it's very interesting. So when you talk about the level of investment that might be required from government, a lot of MPs are a bit like, oh, that's a lot of money. But when you talk to them about their own constituency, they're absolutely clear that there may be some other sources of finance, but the government money will have to come into that area in the form of central government grant. So I think we're kind of getting there with making the case, in the sense that people recognise that some central government money will have to go into local areas in order to get social housing built. It's when you look at the kind of big picture of the total of that, it is a lot. But if you look at, as I said, the kind of payback in all kinds of ways, in terms of a less divided society, bringing down the housing benefit bill, which otherwise is just going to go skyrocket forever, I think we can be starting to make that case and make it and get acceptance.
Yeah. Okay, so Peter has... I lived in Leeds and I managed to escape 9 square miles I couldn't afford to live in by moving to Sheffield. So I do know where you're coming from. I would like to see central government devolve things so that local governments, regional government, whatever, the mayors, had a lot of the power to do this locally, and we trusted them with borrowing. So that everything isn't Stalinist and controlled from Westminster, which is the British model. And then the scope for doing something in East Yorkshire or North Yorkshire and doing something else different in Gloucestershire would be there. And people could decide in their local areas, but at the moment they're simply not allowed to borrow on the international money markets at very low interest rates against a stock of housing, which bar depopulation, the return is absolutely there. Prefabs, as long as the quality is good and it's changed from prefabs in the past. If you look at the legacy of social housing 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s, they got smaller and worse. And we got ourselves into a way of thinking by the start of the early 80s that if you built anything, it had to be worse than the bottom end of the private market. Now, having a policy that says that is absolutely disastrous. So I would happily live in social housing. I just need a guarantee until my youngest child is 18 that we can stay there. That's all I need. I would live in social housing. But without that, I have to try and get a mortgage. What does a mortgage give me? Because I honestly don't believe prices are going to go up much more where I live, because they can't. You have to go to San Francisco to find the nearest highest prices. It's just that kind of security that you need. Different model of arranging it though from council housing. Council housing was a brilliant model when the majority of the population were near functionally illiterate. Like that, that was, you will be told this is your house, you will behave, you will pay the rent, no, or we'll have a fake tenants board, we will, right? And this is what I mean about new imagination. Majority of young women in England have gone to university, right? So we should be using that for how people manage their social housing rather than managing them.
Can I ask why you're referring to young men specifically?
Oh, because young men aren't as good. It's more depressing, it's only 40%. So that's the main reason, it's not what I expect. Although, if you look at who becomes a school governor, who does all these things, men should do them. But we've got ourselves into a situation where women are far now, young women are better educated than young men. And we're treating people as if they still don't know what to do, and a large number of these graduates are going to end up in the bottom 50% of society, because some people, there's going to be some social mobility, and for any social mobility you get upwards, some graduates have to go downwards. Empty stores, the market's falling out of the bottom of the shopping centres in Australia right now, not just here. It's very efficient to have a van going up a road delivering stuff to you. That uses far less petrol than you all driving off on your own. it's just better if it's just one van rather than competing vans delivering goods. If you go to Switzerland, you'll find that in cities like Bern, the elderly are housed in the middle of the city. And if you can get elderly people out of their three or four bed family house, and there's only one of them left, you suddenly free up a family house. Because the other reason for the housing crisis is ageing. Although we've had less ageing than anywhere else in Europe because our life expectancy is going down, but we still have ageing. And elderly people stay in the house even when they can't afford to heat it, because when they die, the grandchildren will get more money. It's incredibly inefficient. So apartments with no stairs at all, European style apartments, the nearer to the middle of city centres as you can, because the majority of people will not drive in old age, you cannot. In fact, most of you, the bad news, will go blind in the last few months before you die. Lastly, Tim, why don't they, and we've got a plan for that, rather than pretending it ain't going to happen. You know, I'd happily be walking around in my Zimmer frame in Dewsbury at the end of my Murfield, actually, that's where I'd like, end of my days. Tim, why doesn't it happen? It's a legacy of a memory of the past. Bracknell Newtown, is what I give you. 41 wards in Bracknell Newtown, not a particularly rich, well-off place. 41 wards, 40 return a Conservative councillor. One Labour councillor, right to buy. It was a magical policy for votes. In places you never thought you'd win councillors' votes and seats. Now go to Bracknell Newtown. There's three, sometimes four generations living in those houses. There's nowhere else for them to go. That's the end of right to buy. It's what we got you without expanding the Newtown. But it's that memory of the 1970s, 80s connection between politics and housing. If you look in Oxford, where I'm from, you'll see a tiny bit of housing. First housing for 30 years has been built on the city. But as soon as you go on the train or the bus in any direction, once you're about 10, 15 minutes out, bang, there's housing in the countryside, which is being built, which is going to require enormous amounts of car driving. Why? And it's not about protecting the greenbelt. It's this legacy of thinking, if you build somebody a detached rabbit hutch in the countryside, they will vote Conservative. If we add more social housing to the city, we're bringing in Labour voters. And it's no longer relevant. It was a good political formula for the 80s. It's no longer relevant. What happens if you carry on playing that formula is an entire generation simply go, oh, I'm a loser. I'm not voting with the party of aspiration because I've worked out the odds, because I've gone to university.
Thank you very much. A few more questions. Lady at the back there. We'll take three, so if you go first.
Yes, my name is Susie Weir. We talked about people living in unsuitable housing where no one's available to call. We don't seem to have discussed in any detail street homelessness. People coming out of the armed forces, forced to live on the streets, committing offences because they don't know how to manage otherwise, ending up in the criminal justice system. They, with the other offenders that they will meet in prison, come out, still homeless, still having to re-offend so that they can survive. That costs far more in the criminal justice system than it costs if we actually invested in housing for the street homeless.
Thank you. Question
in the
back,
from Jeremy.
Thank you, guys. I'm Jeremy Blair, I'm a resident professional, and I don't think it would be my own, but I don't know if anyone has mentioned town planning, and of course it's planning that effectively controls the release of land and supply of housing, which is for the organization that might have in relation to the changes in reforms to town planning.
Thank you, and the gentleman in black.
It's Harry Scoffin from Leeds Hall Knowledge.
Hi there, it's Harry Scoffin from Leeds Hall Knowledge Partnership. If we're talking about making city living work and also flat living work, and we're talking about home ownership, and the minister earlier today was talking about, you know, the accruing of wealth and those with capital will do well in this world, shouldn't we stop selling flats as vulnerable leasehold tenancies? Because it gives landowners huge powers and consumer home buyers overnight are becoming mortgage tenants. What's your view on leasehold? All our ex-companies have gotten rid of it and yet we've kept it.
Yeah.
Leasehold. So we'll take one more question from the gentleman on the corner.
Hi, my name is Andrew Ravels. I'm the City Councillor in Gloucester. First of all, I just wanted to place on record, I'm sure most people's thanks to Bright Blue for organising this session on housing. It's really good news to see Conservatives talking about housing, whether or not we call it affordable housing or social housing, we're talking about housing. I come from Gloucester, as I've said, and there a lot of people are on very low wages, around about £22,000-£23,000 per annum. So, as a city council, we have to do something to ensure that those people are entitled and decent housing is available. And so that's why we try working with our housing associations to provide affordable or social housing, call it what we will. And I guess I'm surprised a little bit that none of you have referred to the role of housing associations, because certainly across the city itself and in the wider county of Gloucestershire, they're making a very valuable contribution to the supply of new homes for people who otherwise wouldn't have access to new homes. They really are doing a great job. Just very quickly, on the point of the last question about the role of town and country planning acts and legislation in the city, Gloucester, I'm sure, as in other authorities, we require each new developer to make a certain percentage of all of their homes affordable housing, and that is another way in which we as a city council are making homes available. Finally, thank you for your patience. Assisting to the director of the charter talking about her experiences with central government, I'm really pleased to hear you making, in particular, the economic case, because as an authority, we've had to spend a lot of money in giving and winding up very quickly. But it's down to all of us also to be missionaries when we're talking to MPs and government ministers to make the case, not just leave it to shelter, and all of us at body conferences and wherever we meet them, to make the case too.
Thank you very much. So four questions there. Street homelessness, control and release of land, selling flats and leasehold challenge, and affordable housing. I'll go to Danny first, for a minute.
Okay, Susie, on street homelessness, we do have to learn from other countries. We currently have the joint highest rate of street homelessness in Europe. We share that honour with Germany. Germany only ranks up with us because they allowed 1.5 million Syrian refugees in, a number of whom are homeless. So we're doing particularly badly. And we don't go and learn from the rest of Europe. We look to America for policy, which of course is far worse for homelessness than we do. I think that's the beginnings of it. Some people do look at the place that ranks highest, which is Finland, which used to have thousands of people homeless in Helsinki, and now nobody's on the streets in Helsinki, but they are in the heated public toilets, you know, but at least they have public toilets and they're heated. It's possible it will be something that a Labour government would do, because it's not that hard very quickly, because the number of people involved are not that hard. But the problem with the ways in which the immediate thing is done, like the Tony Blair government, is you remove the visible impression by doubling the number of hostel beds. You don't actually make people's lives long-term better. Long-term better requires a better housing system overall. Jeremy mentioned town planning. We haven't talked about that. Town planning is incredibly important for the way that housing connects to work and transport and schools. If you have a policy, which we currently do, that you only get a new secondary school, if it's a free school, if a group of parents come together to build one, then you will not get your secondary school in the most sensible place. And if the housing is entirely designed by developers, you will not get it in the most sensible place. You'll get it in the place that maximises the profit for the developers. And your roads will fill up and they'll clog and not move anymore. And we've kind of helped prove this. So we do have to go back to planning, but there are different kinds of planning. I would go for devolution. I would give Gloucester incredible rights and Gloucestershire. And you can argue how much the city and the county should be dominant. I would just like to see central government taken out of it more. The policy of Labour, Shadow Minister John Healey, has said that they will compulsory purchase at agricultural price the land on the edge of cities with severe housing needs. And ever since John Healey said that, if I'd been him, I'd have just kept it quiet and announced it a week before the election. Oxford colleges have been, for the first time in hundreds of years, selling the land on the edge of Oxford to developers. Because even if you think the chance for Labour government is just 5%, what's she doing holding land that could be compulsory purchase at agricultural price? The sad thing is, we're going to be getting 6-bed executive houses with double garages for people commuting to London on the edge of the city of Oxford, because that's what the market tells you is the highest profit. Harry on leasehold, and all our colonies have given up leasehold. And it's relevant, the colony thing. We had all of this because we had a highly successful empire. We were an incredibly economically successful country. And when you're incredibly economically successful, because we were the richest country on earth, because we had the largest empire on earth, things do trickle down. And you can get away with leasehold and all kinds of other squirreling away money here and there, because the next generation know it's going to be better. You can even afford a welfare state in 1945-48 when you're bankrupt, because we were so well off. Now, you either can plan for Empire 2.0, or you can say, oh no, it's run out. We've already taken away the deposit on the future houses by charging £9,250 a year to go to university, which once you put on interest is £50,000, £60,000, £70,000, £80,000 off what you will be able to charge a young person to buy your house. Because the universities aren't stupid, we've taken the money already. Who buys the majority of houses on the open market? It's graduates. So that's all there. Leaseholds have to go, but it's partly accepting that they were an empire thing and they were a trickle-down thing. And lastly, very glad you mentioned Gloucester. The only time I sat next to a homeless man doing a talk about housing was in Gloucester. And it got to me a bit, because he was only a year younger than me, and he had a son who was 1 year younger than my oldest son. And he was just trying to get himself housed somewhere in Gloucester. His son was with his ex-partner somewhere else. And it was a son thing. He needed somewhere where his son could come to visit. He was on the street in Gloucester. And it's funny what gets you and what kind of connects. His son was, I think, 16 at the time. And it wasn't so much for him. He got used to how you sleep on the streets and do that. It's the 16-year-old boy who can never visit dad because dad's got nowhere for him to go to visit. And if you think what might happen to that 16-year-old boy later, because he, in effect, never sees one parent, then you can kind of see the worth of trying to expand the provision to people who are on the edge. You might say you drink, you do whatever, you've got yourself in this situation. But we don't see the wider implications of it all. The great news in Britain is we have more housing in terms of bedrooms than ever still. And even better, the Chinese and some others have built these enormous blocks of flats in London. Because in China, you're only allowed to own 2 homes. It's a rule. If you wonder why so many people from China have come and built over here, or bought over here. So we do actually have an enormous amount of housing, an enormous amount of empty rooms. Most of our housing problem will be solved by some form of redistribution using the existing property. A minority, maybe 10% over 20 years of our problem, will be solved by building, particularly building in the south. Unless we turn again into a net emigrant country, which we were in the early 80s, and we were earlier in the early 90s, more people leave than come, albeit the same pet. And if that happens, we won't need as much housing. But I'm hopeful that won't happen. I'm hopeful we won't be a place where the young actually leave to start a family and get work, in which case we need the plan to build for 10% of our additional need. But we need to better use what we've got. And really, really importantly, we need to give elderly people the choice, not force them at all, give them the choice to move nearby to somewhere which is flat and smaller. I won't go at one political party because they annoy me locally. I like them. The Greens in Oxford, their policy on housing is, if you're elderly and retired and using a large house in Oxford, you should move to Newcastle-upon-Tyne. Now, the problem with that is that when you are elderly, you are restricted to your friendship network. It's very hard to make new friends, and also where your family are. So the elderly in Oxford need flat accommodation in Oxford, and it has to either be converted from existing buildings, all built on the edge of the city, because unfortunately the middle of Oxford is rather full of some things at the moment.
Okay. Great, thank you. Polly, did you want to
comment on that? Just very, very briefly, so, because we're nearly out of time, thank you. So, just where I can add some points, so on the street homelessness, I totally agree that, so there were relatively few people street homeless compared to the total homeless population. So we have 300,000 people roughly homeless, and about 5,500 sleeping rough. And I usually think of it, this is a little bit of a generalisation, but that wider homelessness is a housing issue. A big part of street homelessness is a health issue. So just to talk about a couple of things that we do at Shelter. So it's absolutely right to say that you can get people off the streets if you really want to. You can open up a load of hostels and you can make people go to them. You won't necessarily be kind of preventing street homelessness if that's all you do. A couple of things we do just to illustrate this. In Manchester, we have a project that is really successful where we employ, pay and train up people who have been street homeless and have either been an offender in the past or have had a drug or alcohol issue in the past. And we train them up to do the outreach to people who are currently on the streets and build trust with them to get the support that they need to end up long-term not going back on the street. And that is quite a long and intensive process, and it doesn't involve making people appointments with a particular agency, where then if they don't make the appointment, they're kind of written off and they have to start all over again. It involves quite a significant long-term amount of work with the person. So that's one thing we do. The other thing we do is we work in prison, used to be called Strange Ways, rebranded Strange Ways, and we have a project there where we start working with prisoners on their housing from when they first enter the prison. We start working with them to work out where they're going to stay when they come out, what we can help them with to find permanent or at least stable accommodation when they come out of prison. So they're not faced with that cliff edge that you talked about, you're absolutely right, of coming out of prison with nowhere to live, and that is going to lead very likely to further offending, so you're absolutely right about that. But these are quite long-term and complex pieces of work with people who have quite a significant range of needs. Another thing we do in Birmingham, you may have heard of Housing First, so that's a programme which the government has supported to quite a considerable extent actually, where you get somebody who is on the street and who does have quite a complex level of needs, you get them somewhere to live and then you put the support in there to help them to deal with their problems, rather than saying we're not going to give you anywhere to live until you come off here, stop drinking for example, it's yes we will give you somewhere to live and then while you're there we'll support you to stop drinking or whatever your issue is. And that also has quite a lot of success. Again, it is quite costly, but it is a small population. So there are ways of getting people off the streets, but just creating more places in hostels isn't going to do it. So that's that. Just picking up on the role of housing associations, absolutely right, they totally do a fantastic job a lot of the time. you're right. I would like to see housing associations investing more in social housing. I would like to see all housing associations kind of really returning to their social purpose, which is what they were founded for. So I think that is important, but I agree with you, many of them do a brilliant role. In terms of very quickly, what you were saying about requiring developers to have a percentage of developments being social homes, it's absolutely brilliant when local councils really stick to that. So what we need to be really careful about is the developers making excessive use of viability rules that mean that so they get planning permission on the basis of a certain percentage of social housing, but they then say that it's not viable, and that can be defined as much as it means they can't make 20% profit on the development, and they then say, so therefore I can't afford to build social housing, and then it doesn't get built. And thousands of social homes are lost in that way. So we really do need local councils, like I was saying, to stick to the rules that are set out when they grant planning permission and make sure those social homes actually end up built at the end of the development. So that's one point I want to make. And the last thing I just wanted to say about the release of land, because if we want to build more social homes, and indeed other forms of affordable housing, we have got to bring down the cost of land. So what's happening at the moment is that land is being sold on the basis of hope value, so with the assumption that an expensive private development will be built on that land. And that then means that only a very expensive private development will ever be built on that land, because that's the only way that any profit can be made by the developer. So we do have to bring down the cost of land, and there's an increasing coalition agreeing with this. So I don't know if I should mention another right-wing think tank. But Onwards are absolutely in support of this. Create Streets, Campaign for Protection of Rural England, all kinds of organisations are in a coalition now trying to persuade the government to amend legislation so that the cost of land can be brought down. And that is a fundamental to building more social affordable housing. That's it.
Brilliant. Pauline, Danny, thank you very much for your comments. We've covered a lot of subject areas, viability, planning, construction, funding, release of land, to name a few. If you are interested in Bright Green membership and you're not already a member, it's £20 a year for all sorts of benefits, including an invitation to our annual members' reception at Christmas. And I understand there's an exhibition stand that you can speak to somewhere regarding that. Thank you very much to our audience for your questions. This is our last session, so do have a cup of coffee at the back, but thank you very much for coming.